You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 18th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, we have some news about the SGU going to Dragon Con. The news is we're not going to Dragon Con. Unfortunately, I know, it's bad.
Sad.
We've been tracking
this very closely.
You know, we had a meeting and we sort of talked about, is there any way we can go? Like, what could we do? We could put plexiglass and we have double masking. I bought some N95s. But at the end
Even
of the
N96s.
Day...
N96s.
Yeah. N100s.
Yeah, you could do the N99s. But at, you know, at the end of the day, it's just going to be too risky. Like, we have too many vulnerable people in our, you know, in our bubbles. And you know, I can't afford to be quarantined and miss 2 weeks of work. And you know, I work in a hospital. So, and you know, of course, first and foremost, we, you know, we need, everyone needs to be safe, and we have to also, you know, practice what we preach in terms of COVID safety. And we had to make the, it was a painful decision, it really was, because we have two paid events. We have, you know, a whole bunch of stuff scheduled. You know, we were looking forward to being, getting together and doing it, but we just couldn't in good faith do it this year. So we're going to, we're coordinating with, you know, with Derek from the Skeptic Track about what we're going to do. Well, we're happy to stream something. It's stream a live show. We may be doing something for, obviously people get refunded if you bought any kind of ticket, and we may do something special for you as well. We're still, we're going to have to, we haven't had time yet to schedule out exactly what we're going to do, but we'll do what we can. You know, it just, we'll just, everything will be streaming rather than live. And we're really hoping that this spike that we're seeing, which is, you know, it's, hey, to put things into perspective, there are more cases now than there were at Dragon Con last year when we didn't go.
Oh my gosh.
It's worse.
Gosh, really?
Oh yeah.
Like this nationwide is, or just in Atlanta?
No, nationwide. I mean, wow. in terms of new cases per day, absolutely. If you look at the, like, the 7 day average, we're higher than at any point other than the winter spike that we just had. And, but we're heading there. Like, we're that, we're, things are going up.
But what feels so different this time versus back then is that it's so heterogeneous.
Yes.
Like, before it was kind of like, you know, across the country. I mean, we're probably talking about country averages right now, but across the United States, on average, that was a good approximation of anywhere people live. But now it's like, there are hot spots.
What scared me was when we were talking about this and Steve said, you know, it's not like we're, you know, coming over the hump and it's starting to go down. It's still going up at a very steep trajectory. So the scary thing is, in 2 weeks, it could be a lot worse than it is right now.
Yeah, unfortunately, like, we need a certain amount of lead time to make the decision. I was waiting for it to turn around and it just kept going up. So it's just, we got to that point where we had to make a decision. So we're sorry to, you know, to anyone who's inconvenienced by this. And it's, you know, we, as we always said, we may have to react to events on the ground. And that's what we had to do.
Yeah.
And you're right, Kara. It is very heterogeneous. It's because there are, the hotspots are where people are not vaccinated or where governors are taking an anti-masking stance or are fighting against public common sense public health measures. It's all about the public health measures now. It's very clear, you know, that that's happening. And the bottom line, too, is that the Delta variant, which, by the way, the Delta variant is 99.8% of new cases. It's basically that's it, that COVID is now the Delta variant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
It's more infectious. And we're getting to waning immunity on our vaccines. I was vaccinated early.
Time for the
booster. Yeah. So, even if, I mean, the vaccines are great at preventing people from getting really sick and getting into the hospital and dying, but it may not be doing as good a job with the Delta variant of preventing spread. And the Delta variant is much more contagious.
Yeah, so, and you and I, Steve, for example, I feel like I have to be even more vigilant than I was 2 months ago because I got my second dose in January.
Yeah, so we're, you know, 6 going on to 7 months into getting vaccinated.
And boosters aren't available yet. You know, there's new guidance about that that I think we're going to talk about. But, like, I can't go get one tomorrow, so I need to be careful if my own immunity is waning.
So we could slide into that. So we the COVID update for this week, I think we're not giving one every week. I know people are sick of talking about COVID. We're sick of talking about COVID. But this is an important update I thought we'd give. We talked about the open question of if and when boosters were going to be recommended for the vaccines. And so the Biden administration recently announced that they were going to recommend vaccines, boosters, at the like 8-month period for people who got the mRNA vaccines. The J&J vaccine started later, so they're still tracking that data. And now today, as we record this, a joint statement from pretty much everybody, Centers for Disease Control, the FDA, National Institutes of Health, you know, Fauci, David Kessler, who's the chief science officer for COVID-19 response, et cetera, announced that everyone basically is recommending boosters for the Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines starting in September and starting with vulnerable populations, but then opening it up to everybody. So they're very clear about the fact that we're still pushing everyone to get their first vaccine. Like, we need to get as many people as vaccinated as possible. But because of evidence of waning immunity and because the Delta variant is more contagious, we think that the best way to like really, you know, our best chance of shutting down this pandemic is if we give boosters, you know, to people who had those two vaccines. And they'll continue to track the J&J to see if that requires boosters as well.
I don't think this is something that I'm, you know, saying we here on the SGU need to have some sort of conversation about, because this is more of a moral question than anything else, that the WHO has come out and said, I don't think these rich countries should be talking about boosters while so many countries across the globe don't even have access to first doses.
I know, that's a big deal.
Yeah, so it's like there's this issue where in the U.S., the mentality has grown among people who are looking at the evidence. The mentality has been, this is a human-induced disaster. You know, COVID is not human-induced, but the fact that we are seeing people still dying right now is because people are not getting vaccinated when they have ample access to vaccine. Whereas in other countries, it's not. People are dying because they can't get vaccinated because they can't get their hands on the vaccine. And so sort of what is the interplay there? It's something to think about. I don't think it should prevent any of us from, you know, if I go get my booster shot tomorrow, I don't think I'm in, unfortunately, a position where I could have taken that vax, put it in an envelope and mailed it across the globe and said, somebody else take this. So
take it if you can get it.
But exactly.
And that's why in this same statement that they close by saying, we will also continue to expand our efforts to increase the supply of vaccines for other countries, building further on the more than 600 million doses we have already committed to donate globally. So they recognize that, and that's sort of their answer to the WHO. Don't worry, we're going to continue to give a lot of vaccines globally. We're going to donate them. But we also, it's like, you know, when you're on the plane, they say, parents, put your own mask on before you put the one on your child. It's like, we have to sort of take care of our economy and our country and our people. And yes, we will also give, you know, we will donate hundreds of millions, hopefully billions of vaccines to poor countries as well. And there's, you know, Russia, China, they can do that too. You know,
they are.
It's not like it's only the U.S. vaccines, but
for sure. And also, even our vaccines are Pfizer is not, or Moderna, or are they both? They're combined with other countries. They were co-developed across nations. These are multinational companies. I think the frustrating part is that we have the doses ready. They're in the pharmacy. Like, as soon as we decided to get our act together, we got our act together here in the U.S.
Yeah,
and you can literally walk to the pharmacy and get your jab for free in many jurisdictions. Yet people go, no, I'm not gonna.
Oh yeah, I mean, I went to the mall. They had an amazing setup there. There's 7-8 lines of traffic, you know, of areas where you can go in your car. You don't even get out of your car. It was so convenient, in and out like in 40 minutes. So easy and free.
And free. Yeah, I have to say my favorite messages are the ones that are coming in. I just got a direct message on Instagram. I'm not going to obviously list any names to protect privacy, but they wrote, "Hi, I'm about to get vaccinated. I've listened to you and the SGU talk about them, but have been all mixed up. I'm getting one now. Thank you so much."
Oh, that's wonderful.
It's like those are the messages I've heard here. Yeah.
We also talked over the last year and a half about what is the level of herd immunity for COVID. And of course we don't know until we know. But the thing is, it seems pretty clear that the level of herd immunity, which is the percentage of the population that needs to be vaccinated or resistant, so that the virus can't spread, basically. And that number is different for different strains. And the fear is that for the Delta variant, it might be 95%. Like, until we get 95% of the people vaccinated, we're not shutting this down.
No.
Well, I mean, it can happen if we do mandates.
Well, of course it can. But,
yeah,
but
we do mandates.
95%, we have a 95% vaccination rate for school kids because it's mandated.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you feel, Steve, I mean, and this is like, it's almost impossible for us to know, so we're prognosticating a little bit, but do you have a pretty sinking gut suspicion that this is just going to be our life now? COVID is going to be around. We're going to have variant, like a seasonal flu vaccine. Yeah, and there's going to be this weird thing where people either get sick, they die, or they gain immunity. The people who choose not to get vaccinated, and they're just walking around at risk, because eventually we have to get back to being able to drink a coffee in public.
Yeah.
We have to get back to being able to live a life that doesn't feel so restricted, but we're never going to get there until we get over this hump.
Yeah. I mean, I've been tracking this question very closely. Again, I wrote earlier in the year that we probably have until this summer to shut down the pandemic. By having really high vaccination rates, and we didn't do it. We just flat out didn't do it. The variants beat us in the race.
Yeah.
And now I think, I'm not going to say there's no chance, but now I'm reading more and more experts are saying, yeah, we probably missed our window, and I think this is going to be endemic now. It might be endemic largely among children, you know, because of school, et cetera. And we're just going to get, like, every year we get the flu vaccine, we're probably going to be getting a booster every year or whatever. And it's just going to be one more disease that we got to deal with.
Yep. Yeah.
Just in so-called endemic.
You know, this is a really unknown situation because we don't know what the long-term effects are of a child getting COVID that's unvaccinated. Yeah.
It's true. But we do know that a lot of the mRNA vaccines, at least, and maybe the others as well, are actively in trials on young children right now.
I know. We got to get kids vaccinated.
Yeah. Like this, we dragged our heels for way too long on the question of whether or not kids can get vaccinated. And so, like, we need the answer and we need to get that going. Scary.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Kids are getting sick. And and not just that kids are getting sick, but they're spreading this thing like wildfire.
Of course, like kids do.
Yeah, exactly. Like kids
that's
do.
That's what they do.
One of my friends, lives in Texas, and his son went to school like day one. First day he went to school, he got a message from the school saying, your child was exposed to someone that has COVID.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
They probably had that message ready to fire off, you know, ready to go. And just they just had to confirm one case, and they knew it was coming, and boom, that was it.
Oh, we've seen jurisdictions have to shut down their track and trace efforts here in the state. We see they work so well in like Australia, New Zealand, you hear these amazing things on the story where there's like a case. And so we're going into red alert and blah, blah, blah. And now we've tracked 11 people from that one case. So guys, you know, we're back to not wearing or to not leaving our houses. But here you've seen jurisdictions be like, we can't track, like we have to shut down track and trace because literally everybody in the community is getting the alerts. Everybody's exposed all the time to someone who's had COVID because it's so rampant.
All right, let's move on to the news items. And actually, I'm going to start off with a news item that is very similar to what we were just talking about, in that we have a science-based answer to a public health crisis that we don't have the political will to implement. And I'm talking in this case about golden rice. And we've talked about this on the show before. Oh, the good news is that the Philippines just gave approval for farmers to plant golden rice. So last year, you know, January of 2020, the Philippines gave regulatory approval to golden rice as safe. They said, okay, it's safe. It's, you know, people can eat it, but they didn't give the approval for farmers to plant it. So now they have, although it's a generic approval for golden rice, they still then have to give approval to specific cultivars with the golden rice GR2 gene, you know, so there's still that step. There's still some steps before farmers are going to actually be planting it.
Red tape, you mean?
Yeah, it's all regulatory red tape at this point. I mean, the thing that's not red tape is that someone has to actually produce the seed to give to farmers, but and they may want to continue to develop local cultivars, like, because you could breed it with lots of types of rice and breed the golden rice trait into other strains. And so we're going to want to like have it into as many local strains as possible, because farmers are going to want to plant the best rice for their region and their market. And if golden rice is a cultivar that's not the best for their region, then they might not want to plant it. It's going to have to breed it with the ones they want to plant. I'm a little distant, you know, in terms of my information network. And so it is one of those issues where there's a bit of a dichotomy, like you're reading two different camps about like how good golden rice is and how likely it is to get planted. But let me back up a little bit and just to give a quick review about what golden rice is. So golden rice was first developed in 1999 as a proof of concept. You know, we say, hey, these are the genes that we would have to put into rice in order to, you know, give them beta carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A. And theoretically, we can do this, get beta carotene into a staple crop as a way of treating vitamin A deficiency. Vitamin A deficiency is responsible for about 500,000 children a year going blind.
Oh,
about 500,000 children a year, and half of them will be dead within a year of developing blindness from vitamin A deficiency.
So it's worse than just blindness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So blindness is the big thing, but it also compromises the immune system so that they're more susceptible to other diseases. It's bad in a lot of ways. And then, again, half of them actually die, you know, within a year. Now, there are already efforts underway to treat, you know, vitamin deficiency with many methods. Probably the biggest effort is just direct supplementation, just distribute vitamin A supplements. Mm-hmm. And that has cut, you know, rates in half from what they were previously. Also trying to get farmers in different locations to plant crops that naturally have vitamin A in them. Plant sweet potatoes, you know. So that's happening as well. But the numbers I gave you are with all of these efforts already fully underway, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that we'll just keep doing that, it's like we are doing it and it's still a problem. It always reminds me, like, there's so many analogies to other things, like people who are anti-fluoridation will say, just brush with fluoride toothpaste. Like, well, we kind of already are doing that, and that's already part of the... And so,
yeah, that's saturated.
It's not as if people can't brush with, you know, with fluoridated
with vitamin
toothpaste.
A.
So it's like, yeah, we're doing it. We're doing it. And it's not they always try to make it into an either or, but I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So over the last 20 years, what's been happening, you know, neither of the simplistic narratives are true. So some scientists, I think, overstated the case by saying, like, golden rice was ready to go in 2002, and it's been a 20-year delay because of anti-GMO nonsense. It's like, okay, that's only partly true. It's not the whole picture. It really wasn't ready to go in 2002. It was only version 1 was there. It wasn't really, didn't have enough beta carotene in it. They needed to develop version 2. They needed to breed it with local cultivars, et cetera. There's a lot of, you know, stuff that had to happen. They had to go through, you know, the regulatory process. The question was, like, how slowed was this whole process, which had to happen, by all of the anti-GMO activism? And that's a hard number to put, but from everything that I've read, I think it was significant. I don't think, again, I can't put a number of years on it, but it certainly significantly delayed the whole process. So, like, you can't do things like trash field trials of golden rice as part of your anti-GMO activism, and then say that that has nothing to do with the slow pace of progress.
Right. So
they slowed it at every turn they possibly could, tying it up in regulatory nonsense, you know, opposing the research, fighting, you know, doing everything they can to move public opinion against it, getting it banned wherever they can. Like, they did everything they could to frustrate the process. So it absolutely had an effect. You know, if we were, like, full court press for this without all this nonsense, where would we be now? It's hard to say, but there's no reason scientifically why we couldn't be growing it right now. Let me just say that. You know, reading the backlash against the Philippines decision is like reading an anti-vaxxer, you know, kind of pushback. It is really all either logical fallacy ridden spin or it's factual lying. You know, or even if they're not directly lying, they're giving a very specific implication that's not true. So, for example, most famously, Greenpeace remains vehemently opposed to golden rice. This has been very controversial for them. Even, like, former members of Greenpeace have accused them of murdering children. You know, like, it gets really bad. Not that there isn't some truth to that, in my opinion. I think, you know, Greenpeace is just ideologically opposed, and they make every bad argument there is against it.
Which is so a bummer, because it undoes good work that Greenpeace does.
It totally does.
It really muddies the waters.
Totally. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, for example, they say that that approving this GMO crop, right, they have to always emphasize mm-hmm. that, will drag farmers down.
What?
Okay, why is that going to happen? Yeah, how?
Doesn't it just give them more opportunities to grow something?
Yeah. Because this is the so one of the logical fallacies they commit is the false choice combined with the Nirvana fallacy. You guys familiar with the Nirvana fallacy?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, this option isn't perfect, so it sucks, right? It's terrible. Yeah, we can't do it.
Right.
You know,
I literally just said that when I submitted my dissertation proposal to my committee. I was like, usually I would say the perfect is the enemy of the good. In this case, I'm going to say the perfect is the enemy of the submitted.
Right.
That's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. So yeah, it's exactly. It's the perfect is the enemy of the good enough, or the good.
Yeah.
Or say, oh, yeah, vaccines aren't 100% effective. So, you know, what? It was,
right.
So what? Yeah.
Yeah.
So they say that, well, you know, really the problem is that that these, you know, poor populations are over-relying on staple crops, and they're not getting enough of a diversified, you know, fruits and vegetables, et cetera. Like, the purpose of rice has always been as a staple calorie source. It's never been the purpose of rice to be a source of micronutrients. We eat fruits and vegetables for that. It's like, okay, so we're going to fix poverty and transform the farming communities around the developing world.
And food culture that has been established over thousands of years.
So, all right, so you work on that. I mean, go right ahead. Give it your best shot.
Saving children.
Let's do that. But in the meantime, we're going to save millions of kids from blindness and death. Is that okay? Can we do that in the meantime? It's like, and they always use the, you know, when the term Band-Aid comes up, that somebody is making a bad argument.
Right.
It's just a Band-Aid on the problem. And what's your problem with Band-Aids?
That's right. It's going to help until we can.
It's like, oh, these kids, you know, like they fall off their bike and they scrape their knee, and you just put a Band-Aid on it. It's like, yeah, that's right, because they scraped their freaking knee. And now if your problem is with bike safety, you go right ahead and address that. But while kids are scraping their knees, while kids are going blind and dying from vitamin A deficiency, we should try to fix it, and, you know, and using every method that we have at our disposal, not pick out these false choices. Like, no, we have to do this perfect solution of fixing everything and,
or nothing.
And it's not like,
which happens all the time.
Right. But right, also the unstated major premise there is that if we reduce the level of vitamin A deficiency, that's going to somehow keep us from improving poverty or farming infrastructure. Why is that going to happen? Are you saying that we're removing an incentive? No, we have to keep these kids blind and dying so that we have an incentive to fix the farming infrastructure. What's your
point?
That's
the case. That's disgusting.
Terrible.
I mean, they don't say that outright, but that's like
cruel.
The logical implication of what they're saying. Otherwise,
exactly,
it's like,
because if we can fix this problem, trust me, there's another one that's linked to poverty that we need to move on to as well. Like, this is not, this is multi-tiered and multi-layered.
So another thing they go for is the anti-corporate rhetoric, right?
Oh,
so like they say, for example, this is from Greenpeace. This latest development has once again exposed the DA's rubber stamp approval process. Really? Years of slow approval of rubber stamping?
1999?
For corporate-controlled GM crops, please. So the implication, they're not saying that green rice is corporate-controlled, but certainly that's the implication by putting it in a letter about a statement about why you oppose golden rice.
Is golden rice like patented?
So it's
like,
there is a nuanced story, which I am about to tell you.
Ooh,
but the thing is, even more nuanced conversations about it almost always get the facts wrong, especially when they're opposed to golden rice. So here was an article now in The Conversation, right, which is generally good, but it takes a pretty anti-golden rice stance. And they, in one statement, they say that, you know, the promise was that golden rice would be given free to farmers, which isn't true because no one's growing the rice to give free to farmers. So that kind of misses the point. And they said that the rights, the commercialization rights, were acquired by Syngenta. So again, trying to create this sense that a big corporation owns it and is going to commercialize it. Sorry. So here's, and that statement is subtly wrong, but in an important way that puts a completely different paint job on it, right? So this is what actually happened. Like many scientific breakthroughs, golden rice was developed by researchers in universities, right? It was Ingo Petraikis who developed this technology to begin with. And so universities are good at doing research breakthroughs in labs. They're not good at developing commercialized products, right? It's not what they do. So there is frequently a collaboration between universities and corporations. That's how it works, folks, right?
Yeah, they all have offices. What are they called? Like the offices of resource development?
Oh, my God. There's
Yeah. They have like a whole structure that's all about helping individual researchers find the support that they need to patent the ideas that were born out of the university.
Right, the researchers doing what they're doing, and then the corporations take it and do what they need to do for distribution and
but
other
also
things.
The researchers want their credit, and they should get paid for some of this
and
stuff.
They
so
do.
It's all about
the VIG, the university gets their VIG, and the corporation makes they make their money, and sometimes the researchers will like make a startup, go out on their own. Good for you.
Yeah,
but sometimes they say, we can't do this. We need a corporation to do this for us.
Right.
So what happened was Syngenta didn't acquire the commercialization rights for golden rice. It was given to them so that they could develop it into a product. They were helping out, essentially. So what Syngenta did, because it has corporate infrastructure, is it acquired it acquired the licenses for all of the patents, with many, many GMO patents involved here, all of the ones that were necessary for a golden rice product to exist. They also developed it into the GR2, which is now the current version, which is actually the viable version that has enough of the beta carotene in it. However, here's the thing, and you have to know this to understand the story. Well, so Syngenta now either owns or has a license to all of the necessary patents for golden rice, for GR2. And if they wanted to, they're the only company who can commercialize it, meaning make money off of it, but they have chosen not to. They have no plans. They have no plans to commercialize golden rice. What they did do with it was completely give a license to all of the necessary patents to any humanitarian outlet that wants to use it.
That's now the
International Rice Research Institute, right? So they said, all right, you guys, here's all the patents. You have them completely free, and you can, but for humanitarian use. You can't commercialize, turn around and sell this for profit.
Yeah. Right. It's like the polio vaccine.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of, I don't know what the red tape was, but that's kind of what was decided with the polio vaccine.
This destroys every narrative that Greenpeace and the anti-GMO people have. So basically, Syngenta retains the commercial rights with no plans to ever use it, and they've given over all of the patent licensing for free for humanitarian use. And humanitarian use means, I'll tell you exactly what that means, use in developing countries, resource poor farmer use. Technology must be introduced into public germplasm, so the seed only, so public, you can't sell it.
Right.
No surcharge can be charged for the technology. So in other words, if you sell the seeds, you can only sell them for what the rice costs. You can't charge
profit.
A premium for the golden rice trait.
I see.
Right? So if whatever that cultivar costs on the open market, that's what you can charge for it, no more. National sales are allowed by farmers, so they can sell within their own country. That's how you get the seed into urban areas, right? And farmers can reuse the seed. They own the seed. They totally own whatever seed that they create. What you can't do is export it for profit, because they want it to be grown and available and used in the developing countries where people need the nutrition.
That makes sense.
Sounds pretty good, right?
Basically like saying, we made a thing. The thing could help people. You can use it to help people. But the minute that you greedily start to make money off of the thing I made that I technically own, you can't do that anymore.
So Greenpeace characterizes that as corporate-controlled GM crop. Come on.
Oh, my God.
That is And even saying that Syngenta acquired the rights to it makes it sound predatory. Like it's all a big con game. Yeah. It's all bullshit. So anyway, it's available freely for humanitarian use.
That goes even farther than I expected, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
And it also... Like, it makes me very happy, first of all. Like, I feel good in my moral core. But at the same time, it sort of reminds me of some of these same arguments that you hear from anti-vaxxers, which are like, I don't like how these pharmaceutical companies that funded all the research and development, by the way, of these vaccines, quote, own them. I don't think that's fair. And it's like, first of all, you can have that argument and you can get into the weeds with that, but do you think that should prevent us from vaccinating people right now? Hell no. How about we talk about that after?
It's like two different arguments, really.
Nip this global pandemic in the bud.
Right. And let's talk about destroying their motivation to do the research. Let's take the fruits of your research away so that in the future, you don't spend scores of millions of dollars to develop anything like it again. Let's do that, shall we?
That's a longer argument. But the other thing is that anything that develops from, like, if you use the golden rice seed that you're given for humanitarian uses, you develop a new cultivar out of it or something new from it. Syngenta still owns the rights, but those are automatically available for humanitarian use too. So this covers anything that might even derive from it automatically falls under the humanitarian use agreement. What more do you want? What more do you want? Right? Now, the other thing that Greenpeace does is where have we seen this before? Right? So after spending decades fear-mongering and turning as many people as they can against golden rice based upon lies and misconceptions and distortions, they then say, all these people don't want it. Oh, yeah. Who cares? They don't want it because you've been fear-mongering about it.
Yeah.
It's like
all these people aren't sure who won the election.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to, Bob. It's like, people want to feel secure about want to feel secure about the election that we've been spreading lies about. So anyway, it's exactly the same thing. It's like an organic farming does that too. Like you sort of fear-monger about GMOs, then you go, and they literally said farmers will be harmed if the GMO contaminates their other products and people won't want to buy them because they're GMO. Right, so it's like, they're sort
pissing
of
me off,
it's
Steve.
Justifying.
Yeah, it's like, and whose fault is that?
Yeah, it's like they're justifying fear mongering about GMOs because they've been fear mongering about GMOs.
Okay. See, we were right.
Because they're doing a good job at their smear campaign.
But the thing is, I mean, I still don't know what's going to happen. Bangladesh is also on the verge of kind of approving it, which is good. And a lot of objections also come from, we haven't proven this safe yet. It's the precautionary principle. It's safe. It's been demonstrated adequately enough to be safe. Yes, we haven't given it to millions of people yet because we haven't done it yet. It's like saying the vaccine's not proven safe when based upon the trials until we give it to 100 million people. We can't give it to 100 million people until we give it to 100 million people, you know?
True. But there's also no face validity in that. Like, it's a completely different argument to say, I'm worried about this vaccine, which, as we know, vaccines can have safety issues. We've seen it before and we know about Epstein-Barr and we know about all these issues, yet we have done all the work to render this safe. It's rice.
Right.
Rice with vitamin A.
What do they think the risk is versus
it's just they don't they can't even say it's just the precautionary principle. We don't know for 100% sure that it's safe. So let's just can it. Just forget about it.
But it's not a drug. We don't have to do double blind randomized controlled trials on rice. Nobody in the history of humanity has had to do that.
Not when we're enriching it with vitamins. I mean,
Kara.
It's food.
I know,
it's not like we're putting steroids into the.
I know.
This is the typical.
It's Frankenfood.
They didn't use any kind of logic to put themselves in the position that they're in. Like, it's the whole thing is illogical from the get-go.
The thing to keep in mind is that not a single animal or human being has ever been harmed by a GMO ever. There's no evidence for a single organism being harmed by a GMO crop.
Right. Right. Mm. Do you know how many times I hurt myself eating Doritos?
Oh, like when you get the cut in the corner of your mouth and the salt. Oh.
Is that when you're eating them alone in a tent, Bob? No, shit. A hammock. A hammock. Damn it. I screwed up my callback.
So I hope this works out well. because it's not going to solve all the problems in the world. It's not going to even solve all of the vitamin A deficiency. You know, but there's the estimates are that one cup of golden rice has about enough vitamin A for half of what a child needs, which that's good. Half is better than none. Maybe they'll eat two cups of rice.
Who knows?
But I think anything we can do to chip away at such a horrible problem that affects poor kids in developing countries. That's the thing. Like, the narrative is so bad for Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. It's so bad. It's like they're really struggling here, and I think they're going to lose this PR battle. I think they're going to totally lose.
Because the only difference here is that the food, it's pre-fortified. It doesn't require a factory to fortify it the way that we do with many grains and cereals that are packaged. This actually allows us to cut out all of the expense of fortifying something after the fact, which clearly we haven't been able to do sufficiently in these countries. We're just pre-fortifying the seeds. Why is that not a good thing?
And there's research to fortify rice with zinc and iron, and they could stack those. So now you're going to have nutritionally enhanced crop. See that? So again, like every standard narrative that they use, like, oh, this is only about profits or pesticides. Nope, this is not about profits. It's not about pesticides. It's not about big giant seed companies. No one's going to make any money off of this. This is totally humanitarian. It's to help poor people. It's nutritional enhancement. No one is charging for the patents. There's no evil corporation involved. None of your narrative BS applies. And you know what I mean? And there's no safety issue. It's just nothing. They have nothing.
Right. But even though they have nothing, Steve, they have still fought and delayed this. The hope is that once this is successful, that the next time you step it up and you have something that's not the poster boy for GMO like golden rice, it'll be a little bit easier, even though if it'll be easier for these people to decry it and say, no, this is horrible. So I just hope.
I think this story will have a happy ending. I really do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's also, I'm going to end on another bit of good news, which is tangentially related, because this is something we learned at Nexus. We had our researcher who's developing genetically modified bananas in Africa. Because of CRISPR and other technology, genetic altering technology, there is a separate category of gene edited crops. Gene edited crops have had their genes altered, but no new genes inserted, right? Mm-hmm. So genetic modification means you had a gene inserted.
Yeah, it's actually transgenics. Why genetic modification.
Well, it could be cis or trans. It could be a cisgenic or transgenic, but it's all still genetic modification. Mm-hmm. But there's a separate category of genetic editing where you're just editing the genes that are already there. In many countries, the United States and I think Australia and some other countries, gene edited crops are not considered GMO and are not regulated like GMO.
Good.
They are regulated like just any other food.
Yeah. Wow.
The big region that chose, unfortunately, I don't know if we talked about this on the show, they chose to categorize gene edited crops as genetically modified, is the European Union. They're really anti-GMO there. And there's some other countries that haven't decided yet. So we have to, I hope that, most of the undecided countries decide not to regulate gene-edited crops like genetically modified. Yeah. And that could be a really good end run around the whole anti-GMO thing. Because, because if all the regulations they've been fighting for don't apply, then it kind of scuttles it.
And Steve, let me amend one thing you said. You said you think this is going to have a happy ending. I want to say that this is going to have a partly happy ending because of their delays and anti-science attitudes, kids have died and gone blind. That wouldn't have. Yeah. So it can't be.
It's almost certainly true.
Yeah.
Hard to put a number on it, but it's almost certainly true. And they're still doing it. Like, they're still trying to encourage farmers not to grow it. And then if they don't grow it, they say, well, it failed. People didn't want it. Yeah, because you fear-mongered about it. Just terrible. Okay. We're going to move on to a completely different news item.
Whoa.
Jay, you're going to tell us about Moore's Law. Is it finally coming to an end? What do you think?
Well, I'm sure you guys have heard of Moore's Law. Gordon Moore, who created Moore's Law, is a co-founder of Fairchild Semiconductor and Intel, a company you may have heard of. He predicted from observation that the number of transistors on a microchip, and you can call this the transistor density, will double every 2 years, right? You've heard this. And his prediction has been consistently correct since 1975, or has it? or has
well,
it?
I was told it was
right because it just became
roughly correct. Yeah, yeah, on average. Yeah,
but you know, it seemed you know, but it did certainly sound like you know, every 2 years, very predictable that you know the number the density would double and then the cost would you know they say it halves, meaning that you're getting more for less money. Because consistently, you know, the prices kind of stay the same, but you're getting more for that same amount of money. So right. Anyway, researchers at the Rockefeller University published a paper in a journal called PLOS1, P-L-O-S-1, that clarifies the actual reality of the transistor increase over the years. So now we're going back to 1959. The researchers discovered that there were six waves of microchip improvements. Each wave lasted for about 6 years, and during each six-year wave, the transistor density increased at a minimum of by 10, right? So it went up an order of magnitude. So then after the 6 years of growth during that wave, there was about 3 years of, you know, mostly no improvement.
A plateau, sort of.
Yeah, it was like roughly a nine-year cycle. You know, an engineer comes up, group of engineers come up with some type of insight and they say, hey, we can modify it this way and that way, increase the density. And by the time they bring it to market, you know, and everything, it's, you know, it takes a lot of time to do that. They don't just come up with it and they're pumping these things out. Like they literally have to retool factories and stuff to be able to do these types of things. And then, you know, as that new improvement, becomes common and they proliferate the chips out, there's, you know, a period of time where there's a cool down and there isn't so much innovation going on. So it makes a lot of sense from an engineering perspective. According to this trend, we're currently now overdue for the next wave of improvements. And I'm, you know, I'm ready. Let's do it. So we have an incredible, right? Come on. Like, don't make me
Jay's ready.
So we have an incredible demand for smaller and more powerful processors as this proliferation of computers continues. Everything has got a computer chip in it, right? It's, you know, it's remarkable how many computers, if you want to like, you know, label something as a computer because it has a processor, we have computers all around our house. They're everywhere, you know.
Vaccines have chips in them.
Well, come on.
Oh, wait, there that's a go. Secret. Sorry. Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys know this, but there happens to be a global chip shortage right now. The chip shortage has been accelerated by the COVID pandemic, both because demand went up during the pandemic and manufacturing took a hit at the same time. Mm. So the beginning of the chip shortage can be blamed back on the automotive industry. When car sales dropped, the automotive industry buyers canceled a lot of chip orders. You know, hey, we don't need as much as we were going to order because we think that sales are going to be bad over the next couple of years. But the car sales didn't really go down that much. And as they anticipated, so they ended up placing back these huge orders for more chips. And the chip manufacturers were actually affected by this yo-yo because, you know, they're trying to scale their manufacturing to meet demand. You don't want to have more manufacturing than demand. And you surely don't want to have more demand than manufacturing. So every company is trying to balance these two things at the same time. So that had an effect. Now, other factors affected chip production. As an example, like the power outages in Texas, right? Samsung's semiconductor manufacturing operations are in Austin, Texas. And when the power went out, hey, the factories got shut down because, you know, hey, that's the way electricity works. So another major chip manufacturer called TSMC in Taiwan was having manufacturing interruptions due to a severe drought. And yet another factor is the U.S.-China trade war. So some companies in China have been stockpiling chips and other needed components since 2020. So, you know, you add all these things up, and the really scary truth here is that we have Samsung and TSMC, these two different manufacturers, they make the bulk of the processors that the world uses. And these two companies are literally right now, they're maxed out as far as production goes. Big companies like Microsoft, Sony, you know, Nvidia that makes the graphics cards for computers, AMD, and Apple rely on these chips from these suppliers to build their products. They don't make the chips themselves. People who needed to work from home, as an example, led to more computer sales because of the pandemic, and more game consoles were being sold over the pandemic. And graphics cards are now, and even cell phone, the chips that go in cell phones, all of these different manufacturers in all of these products are feeling the chip shortage. And let's not forget, of course, you know, I have to mention that cryptocurrency miners who now are largely using PC graphics cards to mine new cryptocurrency, right? So they use these GPU processors. because they're super powerful and they happen to be very good at running the calculations that need to be done to do crypto mining. So if you go on Amazon and look up the price of a typical graphics card for a PC, the cost could be three times that of MSRP, right? The manufacturer suggested retail price, let's say, as an example, a good high-end graphics card should cost about $1,000. That's what the manufacturer says. Well, guess what? It's about $3,000 right now. And the SGU needs a couple right now for the studio. Ooh. And Ian and I have been like, nope, we are not paying $3,000 for a graphics card. No way. That thing would have to like do the lawn, wash my car, and do the laundry while it's running the computer, you know? You know, so a lot of different sectors and consumers are feeling the chip shortage. Now, building new factories seems like an obvious fix to the problem. Well, you know what? Yeah, of course that's what they're trying to do, but this costs billions of dollars and it takes many years to create a brand new factory. Like, it's not like, hey, let's just, you know, throw up a building here. Like, we're talking about incredibly precise machinery that has to go in. You know, it takes a long time to put one of these types of facilities together. You have to staff it. You know, it's like these people are, you know, it's not like there's, these people falling out of the woodwork. You got to train people to be able to even just run the machinery and do all the heavy lifting. It's a big freaking deal to build another plant that can make more chips. And they're doing it because they want to make, you know, they want to meet the demand. But it's not going to be a quick change in the short term. Like, you know, we're going to be stuck in this zone, you know, probably a couple more years. So on top of the shortage, experts are saying that the chip advancements themselves, right? So let's go back to talking about just, you know, the chips increasing their transistor density, right? The advancements that we want to have happen, they're saying that historically we got about two more waves left before we hit the physical limits of miniaturization for silicon-based chips. So it begin to cost exponentially more money to make gains, and the gains will start to significantly decrease. So, you know, right now they're moving at a pace and everything seems to be, you know, as normal, but we could tell by the physics of what's happening on the silicon chip that we just can't keep doing it, that it's going to be an unfixable physical limit. There's nothing that we can do to get past it other than developing new technology. So what is that technology? Well, here we go. Now we're getting into like technologies that don't really exist yet, but we are working on. Companies are working on it. Lots of, you know, probably billions of dollars are being dumped into these ideas, like nanotransistors, right? You know, nano means at a certain microscopic scale. You know, nanotransistor is incredibly small. I also read about atom transistors, like atomic transistors, which are like probably using the bare minimum number of atoms to create a transistor, you know, like an electrical transistor. Amazing. And then we have quantum computing. Now, don't get me freaking started.
Yeah,
too late. You know,
Bob, Steve, and I have done an incredibly deep dive on quantum computing for our book that's coming out.
Which, by the way, is completely written and sent off to my agent. We'll get
the
publisher.
All right.
Very soon. The first draft is totally done.
Very
coming
exciting.
Out. Probably first quarter in 2023.
The quantum computing isn't going to be like this thing that replaces your PC. A quantum computer is going to be like a super, 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 super computer that you rent a very small amount of time to use to do your processing. And then another company will rent it, you know, for another short amount of time. But there's not going to be like millions of these quantum computers all over the world. Like they have to actually like have almost absolute zero in a component inside of it just to whatever. Don't even. I can't even. I still, yeah, I could say everything that they say about it. I don't understand it. Yeah. That's how complicated it is.
Your OS is not going to be on a quantum computer. It's not just
no.
It's certain things it's very, very good at that you don't do normally. So researchers will love it.
We might have nanotransistors in some future CPU. But right now, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We literally don't know. Like we have a certain number of years that we could predict that we're going to be able to continue the same progress. But Moore's law is going to end when we hit the physical limit. And it's going to be in most of our lifetimes, we're going to see that limit get hit. And then luckily, hopefully there'll be this elegant transition to a new technology to keep the pace. But you know what? It might not happen.
At some point, the physics has limits. You know, you can only get so hot and so fast until you create a computer that's so dense and hot that you create a black hole. I mean, there's limits. You know, there are limits, and but I think we're pretty far away from limits. But I mean, I think if memory serves, I think some of the fastest computations that could potentially be done. I mean, they're talking like 10 to the 50 computations per, you know, calculations per second, something like that. I could be off by a little bit. But that's, so there are limits, but we're not near there. But eventually we will hit the limits. And knowing what those limits are, I think is fascinating.
Well, Bob, when they say there's two more waves, you know, just following the pattern that we've had in the past, the waves, you know, there's 6 years of progress and growth and 3 years of kind of stagnation. So that's, you know, we're talking 18 years. We're due for a wave right now, following the pattern. So we, you know, right now and then, you know, go forward 9 years and then we have another wave and then we're kind of at the end.
But here's the thing though, Jay, is that while technological advancements is not linear, problems are also not linear. And I think, you know, we were talking about this before. You were pointing out the fact that the getting more and more transistors onto a computer chip is harder and harder to do. It's a non-linear problem. That means it takes an incredible amount of more work and research and development to make the same amount of advance as you go forward. And we're just getting to the sort of steep part of the curve where it's really hard to push forward. And also that non-linear aspect of the problems themselves is also not evenly distributed, because you reach bottlenecks or hurdles that you need to get over. And so what you're saying is we're getting to a hurdle where it's just linear advancements is not, incremental advancements not going to do it. We need a new paradigm. And nobody knows what that is until we know what it is. And sometimes it doesn't happen. You know, the coming hydrogen economy never came because we never got over the hurdles. And will we do it in the future? Who knows? You can't predict those things.
Does this invalidate Moore's law because we're running up against this hurdle?
I mean, Moore's law is, you know, works.
It's more of a guideline.
You know, yeah, it is a guideline, and it was never meant to be infallible forever. And the transition from one paradigm to the next, who knows what the next paradigm is? We've been lucky to relatively easily go from one paradigm to the next. But at some point, who knows, after silicon, we could potentially go for a couple decades or more without something that really allows us to pick up the pace again, you know, and keep going. I mean, we're really approaching some fundamental limits with silicon, and it can't tweak that forever. And yeah. Some people thought that it would have ended, you know, even before today, but we're getting near to the end, and hopefully there's another paradigm coming.
Well, the good news is that human ingenuity is incredibly powerful. You know, we have people all over the world, and again, these companies are spending billions of dollars doing R&D, and that's what we need. That's why a healthy economy is so powerful, because it allows companies to invest money into these technologies, like the mRNA platform. Like, we were lucky that the money was there for these companies to put the time and energy into developing that platform, because we needed it. You know what I mean? Like, there came a time when we really needed it. Computer processing, the more powerful computers we have, the more we can do, and the more incredible things that we can get, you know, hardware and software to do for us and our lives. So the need is there. The money is there. It's just, we just got to hope that the ingenuity is there to make it happen.
We just need the nerds.
Yep.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, the NHTSA, NHTSA.
Hey, guys, let's say you're hanging out with some friends and putting back a few drinks, and a few becomes a few too many. As the evening comes to an end and people start to head out, you think calling for a ride, but nah, you live nearby, you can make it home, okay, you know? It's no big deal. What are the odds you'll get pulled over anyway? And even so, what's the worst thing that could happen, right? Is this what you're saying to yourself? Your insurance goes up, you lose your license, you lose your job, you total your car, you kill someone. Everyone knows the risks of driving drunk. The results are tragic and often deadly. However, that still doesn't stop everyone from getting behind the wheel while under the influence. That's why police officers are out there right now looking for impaired drivers on our roads to save lives.
So if you think you're okay to drive after a few drinks, think again. Play it safe and plan ahead to get a ride. It only takes one mistake to change your life or someone else's forever. Drive sober or get pulled over.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Carrie, so you sent me this news on it, but I had already seen it. It's very cool. I mean, I couldn't resist brain organoids with little eye cups.
Yeah.
Tell me what's going
on. It's really cool. Okay. Aww. They really look like, let me describe what they look like first. They look like little egg yolks.
Yeah.
They're not egg yolks, but they look, because they're clumps of cells, they're brain organoids, and they've got these little brownish, blackish, almost like a snowman with coal eyes. Yes. That's what it looks like, except it's under the microscope. So now that you can envision that, hold that image in your head while we talk about this. This is based on a study that was published in Cell Stem Cell. The name of the study, which kind of has a lot of weight to it, is Human Brain Organoids Assemble Functionally Integrated Bilateral Optic Vesicles. What does that mean? Let's break that down. We've talked before about organoids, right? They're these little brain-like things that can be grown in vitro, outside of the animal, from induced pluripotent stem cells. So let's break that down. We know what stem cells are. They're cells that can become things. They're precursor cells that aren't the things that they're going to become yet. Pluripotent means they can become lots of different things. They're not dedicated to becoming one thing. Induced pluripotent stem cells mean that we've backward engineered adult, or not adult, but older cells to be able to go back to that kind of primordial form to then be able to become whatever we induce them to become. So these are induced pluripotent stem cells that were utilized to derive human brain organoids. Okay, so this is not new, brain organoids, but it's really cool. And so, you know, any study where they did something cool with brain organoids is already interesting, but this one has eye spots. I don't, you know, sometimes they refer to them as optic optic cups. Sometimes they're calling them optic vesicles. I think the issue here is that this isn't a real brain. It's a blob outside of the organism that was grown into brain-like tissue. So because it is an organoid, they're also not eyes. They're eye-like things.
They're ioids.
Yeah, they're ioids, opticoids. So in the study, they refer to them over and over again as optic vesicles, but in all the write-ups, they refer to them as optic cups. And I think that's because when you look at the actual anatomics of what an optic cup is, it's the little disc-like shape where the retina would eventually sit in and grow from. So
is it concave?
Yeah. It's like a little cup.
It's like a very primitive eye then. That's primitive eyes.
Sort of, yeah.
We're like that.
A good way to put this is that it is kind of like a primitive eye. I mean, it's sort of that ontogeny and phylogeny, you know, question, right? We're here talking about development. We're not talking about evolutionary change, but you do see that, you know, it's not a perfect metaphor, but that some of the things that happen developmentally also happen when we talk about evolutionary development. And you're right, there are organisms, or historically there were organisms, that had very simple eye spots. These brain organoids grew these very simple eye spots. But here's the coolest thing about it. This is the first time it's ever been done out of the brain organoid. So other researchers have grown primitive eye-like things, optic vesicles. Other researchers have grown brain organoids. These researchers grew brain organoids, and then they were like, I wonder what would happen if we add some of the factors that are necessary for these eye spot things to grow.
Yeah.
I wonder how they would grow in conjunction with these cells. And so they tried it out, and it worked. And it worked in something like 73% of the 300 some odd attempts that they made. So it's reproducible.
I don't find that surprising at all, because I mean, aren't your eyes essentially like pieces of your brain?
Extensions of your brain.
Yeah, so
it's really what they are.
I wouldn't call it brain, but it is definitely central nervous system.
It's central nervous system.
Yeah. Right. So because your eyes do have nerve cells in them, right? And they're central nervous system cells. So there's a lot of different types of cells in your retina. In this case, they were looking a lot at retinal, thought they were looking at retinal ganglion cells, but they're also looking a lot at the pigment epithelia. And the cool thing about these eye spots is, as they started to like learn more about them, they started to see a lot of things that are reminiscent, or that tap into more mature, organized eyes. So first things first, around day 30 of these little or brain organoids growing, they started to see the optic vesicles being assembled. And then by day 60, they were visible structures. So they could see them kind of at the cellular level by day 30. By day 60, they were like, holy crap, that looks kind of like an eye, which is really cool. And when they looked at these kind of the structures and what was going on cellularly within these optic vesicle containing brain organoids, they found corneal epithelial cells. They found cells that look like lens cells. They found retinal pigment epithelia. They found progenitor cells, so things Damn. That would eventually grow into retina. They found little projections that look like the axons of these neurons. They even found that they were electrically active. So here's a cool thing. If they turned on the lights or turned them off, they would respond.
Interesting.
So they were photosensitive. They were able to photo bleach them and reset their photosensitivity. So it wasn't just a one-time thing. They were continuously working and able to detect light. And all of this happened in a self-organized way. Like, that's the really cool thing. So they're putting off certain factors that you only will see in eyes. Like, they're putting off myelated neurons. They even developed microglia, like things that are always going to be developing within brain and within these eye structures. And it did it in a kind of self-assembling way. So
wow.
That's kind of, I always find that's a really cool thing. It's like, if you give it all the ingredients, it starts to do what it has learned to do throughout human evolution.
Yeah, self-organization. Kara, did they, when I talked about organoids, I mentioned that the stem cells were reprogrammed. Was there any?
Yeah, these are too. That's why. Okay. That's the difference between induced pluripotent and pluripotent cells that are maybe taken out of embryonic tissue early enough on in development. So they're induced to go back to their pluripotent stem cell state. So they haven't
organized into anything. That's what they meant by reprogrammed.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah. I think that's probably what they referred to when they said they were reprogrammed.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So of course they can become anything. They're inducing them to become brain-like by giving them the types of factors, the types of like proteins and different signals to grow into brain. And so in this case, they said, let's do the same thing, but with eye, but let's do it in the brain or the organoid of the brain and see what happens. And it was like, sure, we'll make eyes. And the other cool thing is the eyes were bilateral and they were symmetrical.
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow. Why not one? Why didn't it develop just one eye or
it's,
eyoid?
I mean, and it must be that these instructions, these ingredients are, I mean, because remember, these have DNA. These are pluripotent stem cells, but they still have all of the blueprints to make life. And so even though, you know, in the lab, researchers can say, you guys can become whatever you're going to become. Let's give you a couple little indicators of to what you should become based on like the food that we give you, based on the molecules that we're putting within your cellular environment. And then they start to grow into brain, or they start to grow into liver, or they start to grow into whatever they're inducing them to grow into. In this case, brain/eye, or first brain, then eye. But, you know, our DNA tells our eyes how to develop. Our DNA tells our body, I mean, it is a blueprint for what, quote unquote, should happen. And when I say should, I mean what is viable. Our DNA has done a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
And our DNA says, let's make two eyes.
Okay.
The interesting thing is, do we know exactly how that works? I don't know.
Just to put a 64,000 foot view on this, when you think about it from one perspective, the brain itself, a fully developed brain, contains orders of magnitude more information than the genes that code for the brain.
Right. Yeah.
So the where does all that extra information come from? That's because the genes are not a blueprint. The genes don't say put a neuron here, connect it to this neuron with these. It doesn't do that. It's just a set of rules for this self-organization. Mm-hmm. And then the brain self-organizes it based upon its environment, its connections, and its feedback. So, you know, part of it is what we call
chemically and electrically.
Yeah.
So it's putting off these different factors. It's firing in certain patterns, and the cells around it are going, that's interesting. I might go to there. Or I want to now fire just like you fired. And eventually, yeah, we do start to see structures form, and we start to see pathways, like actual
and mapping
being formed.
And,
anatomy and physiology.
And that's where all this extra information comes from, the developmental process itself. So with the organoid, you're just getting a clump of cells that's not in the right environment. It's not connected to the rest of the body. It's not getting the sensory feedback and all that stuff that it would normally get.
Survive longer because normally
These are tiny. But you don't really need a blood supply if you can give it everything that it needs. Like if it's small enough.
Yeah, it'd have to be
very
small.
That you can feed it medium. So if you're growing stuff in vitro, usually you're growing it in a dish that has liquid around it. And
that's its energy source?
Well, you're feeding it medium, yeah. So like when I used to grow I used to grow monolayer nerve cell networks. That was all of my research at my master's level. They weren't organoids. We didn't. There's no such thing as an organoid back then. But they were flat nerve cell networks that would self-organize. You would just kind of stick some cells in the middle, and they would start to grow into a network on their own.
Yeah,
because they had everything they needed to do that. But they lived in dishes, in incubators. And every 2 days, I would have to take off liquid and put in fresh liquid. And that liquid had all sorts of things, growth factors. It had sugars. It had vitamin C. It had all the nutritional components to keep the cells alive.
That's great for flat cells. But when you've got like a million cell clump of organoid tissue, the ones that I talked about a couple of years ago, they would die after just 3 days without
I could see that if they were
supply.
Big. But these are, I mean, these are still microscopic. They're small. So if they're floating in this liquid, I think that they're getting what they need. But you're right. It's probably going to limit the size until you can start to deliver vasculature or some like some sort of what would you call it? Like a PICC line or some sort of a stent, a shunt, a tube to get to the innermost layers. Otherwise, you're right. It would die because the middle wouldn't be fed.
Feed them golden rice.
Yeah. So, but these are small. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting question, Bob. Like, eventually, if you want to start modeling, like, different areas of the brain or different structures, this is so simple. I don't want to say it's homogenous because it's probably not homogenous. I have no idea if there's any kind of self-organization happening within this glob of cells. But it seems to be the fact that they sort of developed the way they were going to develop. And then they didn't want to – they used the same protocols they had been using to make organoids before. It looks like it was a four-brain organoid. And then they added retinol acetate to the medium after it had started to develop in order to aid eye development.
All right, Bob, tell us about the latest advance in fusion energy.
Yeah, fusion news this week. The United States National Ignition Facility, which we've talked about, claims an important milestone recently in fusion power research that one researcher dared to call a Wright Brothers moment. So what happened?
And
is it really a Wright Brothers moment? Yeah, I totally get it, Stephen. We will talk about that. I may have to slightly disagree. But all right. So fusion power research is, of course, considered one of the holy grails of energy research. You know, the fuel is essentially limitless. Virtually zero carbon emissions without most of the downsides of fission. I mean, this is just such an amazing thing that I've been waiting most of my life for. So fusion, very simply, very, very simply, combines elements to create a new element plus a little bit of energy. That's probably the simplest explanation of fusion I could think of. So in my opinion, though, there's four types of fusion that people should know about. Assuming that the word fusion doesn't make your eyes glaze over much the way the words Dragon Con and NCC-1701 makes Kara's eyes glaze over. So, number one, there's stellar fusion, which occurs in our sun and all stars, for that matter, all stars. Right. And it's kind of important. It's the main reason why there's such a massive local decrease in entropy around us, allowing our life to exist. Next, there's thermonuclear fusion. That's a fusion that occurs at the heart of a thermonuclear or a so-called hydrogen bomb explosion, right? Did you know that fusion actually is happening there? Of course, we need fission to make that fusion happen, but, you know, it doesn't matter. The next two types of fusion, though, are mediated by technology, and we've been researching them as power sources for decades. There's two primary branches of fusion energy research, magnetic confinement fusion, which essentially uses magnetic fields to confine the fusion fuel in the form of a plasma. Tokamaks are magnetic confinement. There's also a stellarator, and there's also a Z-pinch options as well. And you may have heard of ITER and SPARC, MIT's SPARC. Those are tokamaks. Those are toruses, donut shaped. So today's news item is about the second branch of mainstream fusion energy research, and this is inertial confinement fusion. This technique is laser-based, which makes it very cool, and it essentially uses many converging laser beams to force a symmetrical implosion that can compress isotopes of hydrogen that can force then fusion to occur. So this is the technique that NIF uses, and they hit a dramatic milestone this past August 8th, a few days before Jay's birthday. So imagine a pea-sized capsule filled with hydrogen isotopes, and that's suspended in a small container. That container is called a Horcrux. It's called a hold rum. It's a hold rom.
I don't get it. It's okay.
Harry Potter.
Go ahead.
Harry Potter.
And so they hit it with 192 separate ultraviolet laser beams, packing a wallop of 1.9 million joules, megajoules. This bombards the capsule with X-rays that compresses the fuel to something like, get this, 100 times the density of lead, making it hotter than the center of the sun. 100 million degrees. So this creates a tiny piece of plasma. When I say tiny, I mean this little hotspot is so tiny. Imagine a sphere with the width of a human hair. Within that area, we're talking within 100 trillionths of a second, they ignited essentially 10 quadrillion watts of fusion power. Amazing. Of course, it's for a very, very, very tiny speck of time, but it's still, that's a lot of fusion power and very encouraging. So now this
can they capture it?
They captured it for 100 trillionths of a second. It was there. And,
but I think what Kara's asking, Bob, is were they able to use that heat?
Yeah, what can we do?
Constructively? Can we harness it?
No, they haven't figured out how to do that. They used it to measure it. Like, how much is there? Okay, got it. That's all that matters at this point. Yeah. So now this is dramatic. This is very impressive. It's actually impressing pretty much everyone, even diehard skeptics. Now keep in mind, before I go any further, these results have not been peer-reviewed, but the researchers claim that their experiment released 1.3 megajoules of energy, which is about five times the 250 kilojoules that were absorbed by the capsule. If you think about that, that's pretty solid. So let's look at it this way. So in terms of improvement, 1 year ago, their best yield was 52,000 joules. 6 months ago, it was 170,000 joules. Last week, it was 1.35 million joules. So this is where they've gone in 1 year. So that's eight times more than 6 months ago and 25 times more yield than
how
last
far can
year.
We go or they go?
It's, well, yeah, well, you shall find out. So that's 70% of the energy delivered to the hydrogen capsule. And that's important because it shows two things. All right, pay attention. One, the NIF scientists believe they've reached a milestone called burning plasma. I really hadn't heard about this one before. So this means that the fusion reactions are providing enough heat for more fusion to happen. Think about that. There was enough heat so that more fusion was happen. Burning plasma means that the reactions themselves provide the heat for more fusion to happen. And it also means that for the first time, we are now seeing the beginnings of a self-sustaining reaction, fusion reaction, the very beginnings of that happening. So now reaching that milestone is important, not only because you could do new types of research on this type of plasma, but it also means that we are on the cusp of the holy grail of fusion power, one of the holy grails, the ignition point, ignition. Now, ignition point means that a nuclear fusion reaction has become truly self-sustaining. It doesn't just quickly peter out.
It just
keeps going and going. Well, if whatever fuel's there is going to burn, so make sure your fuel is kept away from the kids. So ignition happens when the heat from fusion overwhelms any of the cooling mechanisms that are trying to spoil our fun.
That sounds really scary.
Yeah.
Controlled hydrogen bomb. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And there's a real nice tangent I can go on into here, but that would take too much time. So now external energy is no longer needed to bring the fuel to fusion temperatures so that you could turn off the lasers and let the fusion do its thing. So now once we reach that point, That's a Nobel Prize right there, and there'll be a lot of drunk scientists when you see in the paper that ignition point has been reached. So we haven't reached break even or ignition yet at the NIF, but the dramatic improvements of the past year are not only encouraging, but have brought us to the cusp of ignition, to the ignition point. In fact, Stephen Bodner, who's a retired plasma physicist and critic of NIF, said, "I'm surprised they have come close enough to their goal of ignition and break even to call it a success." He's basically saying that this is essentially a success of their mission, which was to hit ignition. They're so close to ignition, in his opinion, that they may as well call it a success. Stephen Bodner also said that this demonstrates to the world that there's no fundamental reason why laser fusion can't work. And if anything, that might be the big takeaway here, that this really shows that we're so close that it essentially proves that laser fusion works. So let's see. So let's go to the quote. And this is the quote from Omar A. Hurricane. He's chief scientist for the Inertial Confinement Fusion Program at Lawrence Livermore.
Cool,
yes, National Laboratory. He said, our result is a significant step forward in understanding what's required for it to work. To me, this is a Wright Brothers moment. So, okay, Wright Brothers moment. So, this is definitely a statement designed to make headlines and get clicks. You know, if we had reached the ignition point, I'd have no qualms at all about that statement. But you know, so it's a little bit much. But I will say this. The comparison he's making is not complete horse hockey, as Colonel Sherman T. Potter used to say. It's not. The Wright brothers showed that powered flight is possible, right? That's basically what the Wright brothers did. Look at powered flight.
But they actually
is a thing.
Flew, though. This and is they, like saying actually... that their plane design worked in an air tunnel.
Yeah, but didn't they only fly at the beginning for like 3 seconds?
I know, Steve. I'm conceding that they did did not hit ignition. But my point is, I believe you can certainly argue that these results, if verified, show that inertial confinement is a very likely a viable method of fusion. They, like I said, they are so close to ignition that you could at this point, and some scientists are agreeing. They're saying that we're basically there at this point. There's really nothing in our way to get to ignition. Now, it doesn't mean that this will be a practical power source on a large scale. Not at all. It just means that we could hit the ignition point. Just like Kitty Hawk didn't necessarily prove that hypersonic jet fighters were inevitable. They did not prove that. This may not be a viable method, and it may turn out that this type of inertial confinement won't work, and that the more direct method of inertial confinement, which I didn't get into, maybe that's the one that will work. And some scientists believe that, or maybe inertial confinement will never be practical. And we need to use a tokamak. Nothing's inevitable here, but they are so close to that goal of ignition that it basically proves, because a lot of people were skeptical about inertial confinement, they would never get there. And I think this kind of shows that they are so close. They are, you know, pretty much there in some sense. So I'll end with Professor Jeremy Chittenden, who is co-director of the Center for Inertial Confusion Studies at Imperial College London, who said it best, I think, with literally no exaggeration. He said, the pace of improvement in energy output has been rapid, suggesting we may soon reach more energy milestones, such as exceeding the energy input from the lasers used to kickstart the process, essentially ignition. So, yeah, he put it in, you know, the most realistic way. That their progress has been so rapid that it suggests that we may soon reach that next milestone of ignition for inertial confinement. So here's to the potential death of that 50-year-old joke, which is a dig at fusion, that fusion is 50 years away and always will be. I think that joke is going to have to die or be severely modified at some point, because the progress we've been making, even with other methods of fusion, I think they're making such – it's incremental for sure. It's incremental. But at some point, you have enough incrementals where you could say that this looks like it's going to happen for sure at some point in the near future. And they're essentially at the cusp. I wouldn't be surprised if they hit ignition in 2 or 3 years.
So I will – I think that's all reasonable, Bob. Again, my one
good.
Caution –
good. I've achieved my goal then.
Is that – and this has been true of the –
yes, that last little bit, right? That last 5%, right?
It's problems are non-linear. It takes more and more and more energy to get the plasma contained at higher temperatures and densities. And it's not a linear problem. It's like every incremental improvement is twice as hard as the previous incremental improvement. And that's why 70 years ago, they thought it was right around the corner, because they were extrapolating from linear progress that they were making early on. Then they
were like,
oh no, this is getting, every little step we take is getting twice as hard. And so it took a lot longer than they thought. So while we might be technically close, we don't know how difficult that next step is going to be. And that's why I think until we make it, I'm not ready to pop the corks.
Yeah, I'm not popping them either. I hear you.
Bob, am I to take from this, because I understood 30% of the words you used, am I to take from this that we may not even be close, but we now know it's actually possible?
No, I mean, we are close. I mean, basically 70% of the energy was returned.
Okay, so we're close, but we also know now we have a very solid proof of concept.
Yes,
that we didn't have before.
Very solid proof of concept.
Right. Okay. I mean, basically,
which is a big deal.
Right. Yeah. So basically, they went from 3% to 70% in a couple of years. I mean, this is such a dramatic increase. They're clearly on the right path here. But Steve, you're right. They're typically in a lot of these situations, that last 5% it takes 1,000 times the effort it took you to get to 95%, right? And that can certainly happen. They may find that that sphere that needs to be so perfect that they can't get it perfect enough to make the implosion perfectly symmetrical. And there's always going to be like plasma squeaking out somewhere because of an asymmetry, like I was talking about with the neutron stars. That's certainly possible. But a lot of these scientists are so happy and they think that they're so close that it's almost a proof of concept of inertial fusion itself, inertial confinement.
You forgot the fifth fusion, cold fusion.
Yeah, that has entered my mind a couple times this afternoon. So I'm not going to talk about it.
Yeah, the fifth fusion, the one that doesn't exist. Okay. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Man, I was so sure that somebody was going to guess this one, but nobody guessed it. So let's look at what we got sent. I don't know. You guys have any guesses about this?
Sounds like something rotating.
I'm so bad at this game. Sounds like something screaming.
Something trying to start up, like, you know, a crank that you're...
Well, we had a guess from Shane Hillier, and he said, "Hi, Jay, for today's Who's That Noisy, I definitely hear ice cracking. That makes me think it's a guy ice skating on thin ice. But the noisy sounds too aggressive for the sound of skates, so I'm going to guess a guy sawing through ice on a lake." So this is kind of like the beginning of the movie Frozen. But that's
no
not.
Idea. I didn't see it.
Literally, that's, never seen that movie.
Oh God, so cute. Well, I have kids.
I don't have children. Yeah.
So that's not correct. I've never heard anybody saw ice, so I have to go on YouTube and check that out. So I don't know how close you are, but I still don't think it's a bad guess. I think that there's something icy about that, without a doubt. I have another guest from a listener named Greg who says this week's noisy sounds like a liquid pump, possibly on a high pressure liquid chromatography instrument. I work for a company that manufactures them and travel around Western Canada performing installs, repairs, and qualifications on them. Interesting. So a liquid pump. I totally can hear like an air pressure type of thing or like some type of pressurized thing in that sound. You're not correct, but again, I still think that there are some telltale sounds in there that would sound like that. I have another guest from a listener named Susanna Erickson. She says, "Hi, I was just adding photos from a 2002 Australia Great Barrier Reef boat trip to my teenage photo album when you played this week's noisy. It's definitely the sound you hear when you're snorkeling and using a snorkel tube to breathe underwater while floating." Now, a lot of people guessed snorkeling on this one, and it's not correct. And again, though, not a bad guess. I've done quite a bit of snorkeling in my time. And I've done some scuba diving, and it does have like almost like an underwater air sound. I'm not disagreeing with the guess at all. All right, so I have one more guess. This was the closest that I got. This is from Lydia Parsons, and she says, "Hello, my guess for this week's Who's That Noisy is a metal blade of some sort, machete, being ground sharpened on a rotating stone. Thanks, wonderful episode." Okay, so this is what she got correct. My guess for this week's Who's That Noisy is a metal blade of some sort. Yes, this is a metal blade. A metal blade is involved with this. What's actually happening is that this is a curved metal blade being used to do what?
Cut something.
To shave wood.
Sounds like a lathe.
Right? No. Imagine if the piece of wood was facing away from you, like let's say it's a long piece of wood and it's pointing away from you, and you take this curved blade, you extend your arms, you put it down on the wood, then you pull the blade towards you.
Okay.
Right? So here, listen to it again. See that? So it's like a wood carving, wood shaving type of deal. Really interesting because, again, you know, I say this from time to time, there's just so many sounds without the context of seeing what's going on. You just don't know what the hell it is. Like, everything is so contextual.
It's why Foley works in movies.
It's
why when somebody punches somebody, you know, in the face, you can literally crack celery and it sounds the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see that one where I forget the name of it? It's an audio pareidolia type thing where the person is saying there's the same exact mouth movement, but they overdub different words and it looks like he's saying the same, the two different words. It just depends on what word you're reading.
Oh, right? Yeah. It's the McGurk effect.
McGurk effect.
Right. Yeah.
Man, cool. I mean, talk about like reality being created in your brain right before your eyes.
Yeah, that's why we hear like Satan when we play like Led Zeppelin backward and stuff.
Is that what you hear? Satan. Oh my God.
I like the Cookie Monster one. That's a good one. Look it up.
You know which one I love? Did you ever see the one with the count from
Yes, with all the bleeps.
Yeah, and they bleep them out, and they bleep it out at the right time, and it sounds like he's swearing like crazy.
Yeah, because they bleep out every time he says the word.
Yeah.
They bleep out every time he says the word count. So he's like, I like to beep.
I like to beep on the wall and beep on the camera. Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yep, use your brain, fill in the blank.
All right, I have a new noisy for you guys this week. And this noisy was sent in by a listener named Dennis Kiefer. So this isn't the same action being done three times.
I know what that is.
Do you? You want to tell me?
It's that carnival game where you have the gun and you're shooting the red star. You know, those little pellets come out.
Oh, I used to love doing that. You know,
those are fun.
I remember reading a website that tells you how to beat that game, but that game is almost impossible to beat.
Yeah, very tough. The star is just big enough and they don't give you just enough pellets to knock the whole star out. It's rude.
I thought it was the pinball thingy. The boing, like the little thing.
Yeah.
Boing.
You pull back when you play pinball.
Oh, the plunger, or what they call
it.
Yeah.
Is that
a thing? Well, whatever your guess is, if you have one, email it to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And also, please do send me in your noisies. I need to hear them.
All right. Thanks, Jay. One quick email. This comes from, well, actually, this comes from a bunch of people. So at the science fiction last week, one of them was that humans are the only animal that cooks. And as I mentioned at the time, it's hard to prove a negative, right? That there's no animal out there that cooks their food. So all I could do was either search for examples or listen to what I consider to be reliable sources who make that positive statement. Humans are the only animals that cook. So several listeners emailed what they thought were counterexamples, but I don't think any of them are legitimate. So a couple of people emailed me, for example, about Kanzi, who's a bonobo, and Kanzi will start a fire and roast marshmallows. That's pretty cool.
Start a fire with a cigarette lighter or with like two sticks?
No, with matches that were supplied to him.
Mm-hmm. Matches, all
right. The marshmallow's not its food, though. It was given that food.
Yeah, so were the matches. Yeah, the whole
thing. Right. So I'm like, no.
Of course you can teach a great ape to cook over fire. You could teach a great ape to do a lot of cool shit.
I can have him use my computer, cheese, too. But.
Yeah.
Right, but it doesn't count. You know, like he was given the matches. He was taught the behavior. It's not. It doesn't occur in nature.
Right.
It's not a behavior that they engage in. There was another experiment that when I was researching about that I came across, which is interesting. They did a study. They wanted to know if you could teach chimps to cook food. Right. So they created a magic box, which was like an oven. But the way it was designed, because they didn't want to give the chimps actual fire, you know, because of just for safety reasons. So they created this setup that, like, if the chimpanzees put food in a box for a few minutes, then they would replace it with cooked food. So then they would take cooked food out of the box. And so the chimps eventually they learned that if they put food in that box, then it cooks the food, right? Because the food then comes out cooked. It was a black box to them, right? So literally, they didn't know that what was happening. And they wanted to see if the behavior would generalize, you know? And it did. Like, so they were able to, when acquiring other food that they weren't trained on, at some point, like, hey, what if I put this food in the box? You're like, well, will it get cooked, quote unquote cooked? And they definitely preferred the cooked food. Like, they like to eat the cooked food because why not? It's cooked, yeah. But again, this doesn't mean that chimps cook their food. They don't. It was just, experimental paradigm. Someone, you know, suggested there are macaques in, I think it's Japan, that will wash their potatoes in the salt water, and they may like the salty taste that it gives them, but that's not really cooking. And but there was an article about it.
Seasoning.
They called it seasoning. That called it cooking in quotes. Like, yeah, the cooking in quotes, I'm not buying that. They weren't applying heat in order to denature proteins, right? Like, they weren't cooking the food.
Changing the chemicals.
Yeah, they just maybe like the way it tastes when you get the salt water on it.
It's like a condiment, yeah.
Whatever. And then another one gave example of birds that, like, if a fire occurs naturally, they will pick up a stick on fire and do something with it. But again, it was an example of cooking. So I like crowdsourcing these kinds of things because some people might have come across some very obscure, you know, fact somewhere that didn't come up with my internet searching. That happens every now and then. But not in this case. I think, you know, at least so far, no counterexamples of non-human animals actually cooking their food.
That chimp with the box that they gave to cook the food. They opened a restaurant called the Chimprianis.
What's in the box?
All right.
Well, that made me laugh.
Let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and I challenge my panelists skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for just three regular news items?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. Item number one, neuroscientists find that the auditory cortex processes linguistic and non-linguistic sound in parallel rather than serial hierarchical processing as previously believed. I'll explain that one to you, don't panic. Item number two, a study of seismic activity within Saturn that ripples through its gas layers indicates that Saturn has a large, mostly solid rocky core. And item number three, a new survey finds that alcohol drinking among college students actually decreased during the COVID pandemic. Jay, go first.
All right, this first one here, neuroscientist Steve. You know about these guys, right? A little bit? They find that auditory cortex processes linguistic and non-linguistic sounds in parallel rather than serial hierarchical processing as previously believed.
I'm happy to explain that to you.
I think I got it.
Okay.
So basically the auditory cortex, which is the part of your brain that processes incoming sound, whether it's language or non-language sounds, it can interpret them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than having to interpret them one at a time. So if you have multiple sounds hitting your ears, your brain can hear them and dissect what they are at the same time. Is that it?
Sort of. You're kind of missing the key point here. So that's why it was hard for me to explain this in one sentence. I just wanted to back up a little bit. So the classic view was that when your auditory information went from your ears to your auditory cortex, first, it would decide if it was language or not. And then if it decided this is language, it would then go to a deeper level of processing of just language, right? So that's a serial hierarchical processing. You have these like multiple steps. First, you decide if it's language or not. Then you decide, like, if it is language, what words are being said. But what the new study found was that's not what happens. That linguistic sound is just is processed on its own pathway and not in a serial pathway. And so
is non-linguistic sound?
And non-linguistic sound is on a separate parallel pathway.
Well, right, but they're not parallel. They're on their own parallel pathways.
Interesting.
Yes, right.
Where's the determination, though, whether it's linguistic or not?
That's a separate question. We won't get into that.
I see no reason why that isn't science. I mean, a neuroscientist. I would love to hear what your guess would have been if you heard this question, Steve, but that's I have no reason to doubt that. The second one here about the study of seismic activity within Saturn that ripples through its gas layers indicate that Saturn has a large, mostly solid rocky core. Saturn has a large, mostly solid rocky core. I don't know. I'm not sure about that one. I have something tickling the back of my brain that says that there's like ice and slushy shit mixed inside there too. Let me move on to the last one. A new survey finds that alcohol drinking among college students actually decreased during the COVID pandemic. I mean, Jesus Christ, can that possibly be true? All right, well, maybe it is because they were home alone. That makes perfect sense.
If they were remote learning, they weren't hanging out with their friends. So that one's definitely science. I think the one about the hierarchical processing is science. So the Saturn one is the fake.
Okay, Bob.
Now, when you say solid rocky core, what do you mean? Does that mean what? Could it be metallic hydrogen? Or do you mean like rock or what? What do you mean?
When I say rock, I mean rock. I mean, I'm not sure what you're asking.
I mean,
he doesn't mean paper or scissors.
I just think throwing the word rocky in there is just
rock.
Not right.
Like the earth, you know? Like,
I mean, we don't have a rocky core either. But it's just an annoying term for the center. I guess I do. I do. It's just like the implication of it being rocky and not. I mean, can you imagine the pressure and density? I mean, whatever it is, it's got. I mean, last I heard that they're thinking Jupiter had a metallic hydrogen or some form of metallic hydrogen or something like that. I haven't looked at that in a while. I'm not sure what the latest thinking is, but it's something like that, you know, incredibly dense. So Saturn is not nearly as massive. Pretty damn massive, though. I just think it's so ambiguous. I mean, whatever's there, it's going to be solid because of all the pressure. Well, sometimes the heat is so extreme. Oh, there's so many possibilities here, Jesus. all right, let's see.
You sound like me last week.
All right, let's go to the COVID one. Like Jade, my first thought is you got to be kidding. Second thought, well, wait, they're not with their bad influence friends. Like, let's go drinking for the eighth night in a row. No. My two college buddies, my two roommates in college, their record was 21 days in a row, by the way. That sticks in my head. Of course, I did not partake in that. 21 days, that's nuts. So that kind of makes sense. I could have that make sense in my head. The serial hierarchical processing, sure, I mean, but like I said, how does it know? Right. How does it know whether it's a linguistic or not? To me, that's step one. And then depending on where it is, it goes to the proper pathway. So I'm not sure how that would be any different than what you're saying here or what they used to think. Screw it. I'm going with hierarchical processing as fiction.
Okay, Evan.
See, you didn't sound happy when I said that. I think I got it.
So try to read me.
Bob. I know.
You're convincing me. All these little subtle hints and things. I have no idea about the auditory cortex processes whatsoever. So I did not know it was believed to be one way. And then, according to this, turned out to be something else. No idea. I have no frame of reference for this. So I'm lost. Saturn, a large, mostly solid rocky core. Yeah, what would that solid matter be? Iron? Liquid iron? Iron?
Rock.
Iron core. Rocky. Yeah, rocky core. Right? But wouldn't... How could that be? Wouldn't rock get crushed down into something
more... It says, yo, Adrian.
Yeah.
I never use them.
Yeah. I don't know about that one. The alcohol one with COVID. Yeah. So no drinking buddies, less alcohol consumed, you know. Less of that peer pressure effect on alcohol. I totally believe that. The auditory cortex one sounds very impressive. I think that one's going to wind up being the science. I'll have to go with the Saturn one as the fiction. I'm not left with any other choice.
And Kara?
I think I'm going to go with Evan and Jay. I think that we all had the same response to the college one. Honestly, I think that if a kid is drinking regularly all by themselves, like somebody who's in that age range, that's probably a bad sign of alcohol abuse or substance abuse. I think when kids are young and they're over drinking, it usually is a social pressure. Not pressure, but it's a social experience. I think that historically, I thought that this processing was both, like that it's not binary, that there is parallel processing, but then there is some hierarchical processing. Also, but the way that this is written, sort of like it's this rather than what we used to think it was, makes it a bit binary, and perhaps it's more this than what we thought. So that one kind of works for me too. But Saturn being a based on exactly what, but this makes me nervous because Bob didn't pick this one, and Bob is Mr. Spice. He loves spice.
Outer spice.
Talk about that Saturn spice. Okay, but I don't know. Yeah, I kind of agree. This is a gas giant. It's really, 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 really dense. That there would be something liquid, because of that, that it wouldn't be able to maintain its solid structure. So I'm going to go with the two guys and hope that Bob didn't just sweep us.
Okay, so let's start with number three, since you all agree on that one. A new survey finds that alcohol drinking among college students actually decreased during the COVID pandemic. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Yeah.
Science.
I'll drink to that.
And the researchers went into this not knowing, because there was two trends that were in opposite directions. Was the increased stress of the pandemic lead to more drinking, or was the decreased socialization leading to less drinking? So it really could have gone either way. But what they found was that while there may have been an increase of in stress drinking, it was more than offset by the decrease in socialization. So this is a survey data based on college students in North Carolina. And this was first year college students. So the drinking went from 54.2% before the pandemic to 46% mid pandemic. The prevalence of binge drinking dropped from 35.5% to 24.6%.
Not a huge drop.
20% of students reported using alcohol or other drugs to cope with the pandemic. So there was some stress drinking, but that probably masked the effect a little bit. But yeah, but it went down, and that was not necessarily predicted. Let's go back to number one. Neuroscientists find that the auditory cortex processes linguistic and non-linguistic sound in parallel rather than serial hierarchical processing as previously believed. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science, and this one is science. Sorry, Bob.
Whatever. So, answer my question. When is the determination made?
This study doesn't necessarily answer that question, but what the study did show, so it was based upon like 20-year study looking at patients who were having brain surgery that needed to have electrodes placed over the auditory cortex, over that part of the brain. So we had a series of subjects with very high resolution brain surface EEG. And they agreed to participate in the study where they were, you know, they were given different sounds, and we looked at how their brain processed it. And the expectation was that they would be, like with the visual cortex, it's absolutely serial hierarchical processing. There's the primary visual cortex, and there's layers of secondary processing, and then it gets divided into two streams based on whether or not you're looking at something that's alive or not. Etc. So they thought, well, the auditory cortex probably operates the same way, and a little bit harder to study because it's deeper. It's a little bit harder to get to than the occipital cortex where the visual processing is. So it really had to wait for this like opportunistic study like this where we had very high resolution data because they were surgical patients. And they found that, oh, look at that. It's just not operating the way that we thought. These streams seem to be operating in parallel and to be completely independent of each other. They were able to demonstrate, Kara, that it's not just that it's not both, at least in the way they looked at it in the study, because they actually tried to interfere with language processing by using auditory stimulation or interfering with that pathway, and it didn't. It did not interfere with the speech at all.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so what they say is like the functional dissociation was also observed where stimulation of the primary auditory cortex evokes auditory hallucination but does not distort or interfere with speech perception. So they were able to continue their speech processing even when the other, the non-linguistic auditory cortex was being totally effed with stimulation. And they were having auditory hallucinations because they were shocking that part of the brain, but they were still able to do language processing. But as soon as you stimulated the language pathway, they stopped. They couldn't speak. Mm. Yeah, there were sort of several different lines of evidence, both positive and negative, all pointing towards these sort of independent parallel networks rather than one network sort of operating in series, which is interesting.
Yeah,
that's organized that way. It's not what I would have expected either. But that's sort of biased by what we know about other parts of the brain. But they don't have to operate the same way. But yes, Bob, that does open a good question. So there must be some other way, or at what point in this pathway does the brain decide this is speech, versus not speech? Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if other language, if there's no meaning encoded in the speech. because mm-hmm. it's a symbolic to you only, like it's a language you don't understand at all, if that is processed the same way.
And interestingly, when they were effing with the language cortex, what the subjects reported was that they could hear that somebody was speaking. They knew it was speech, which is very interesting, but it was all garbled up, like all the phonemes and the everything yeah. was mixed up. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't make any sense of it, but they still knew it was speech, which is interesting.
Yeah.
All right. All this means that a study of seismic activity within Saturn that ripples through its gas layers indicates that Saturn has a largely, mostly solid rocky core. That is the fiction. So if this was a recent study, what they found was a couple of interesting things. One is that these ripples actually extended to the ring system, which is fascinating. Must be because what? It was causing...
Oh, the seismic ripples.
Yeah, these ripples were not only going through the gas layers, but also through the ring system.
Well, how does that happen?
It must have been causing fluctuations. Must have been causing fluctuations in the gravity, I guess.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But what they found was that the core is a mix of ice, rock, and metallic fluids, and it's very fuzzy. It's not solid at all.
It's like Jupiter's core then.
But that's why it's lighter. But remember, the thing I thought nobody brought up, and this is the thing that probably would have used to say this is a fiction. Saturn's the only planet that would float in water. You guys remember that? It's lighter than water.
Hmm.
So oh, I didn't remember
yeah,
that.
Which kind of so goes against it having a dense rocky
sure.
core.
A dense core compared to the vast expanse of Saturn itself. I mean, that could
that's why
still
I
bring it below
large. I said a large solid
oh,
rocky
yeah.
core.
That's yeah, what
I know.
That would have done it.
It's, I did say large. I said large.
I know, but I'm, so what? That's what I'm saying. I mean, a large core is still a core, and then Saturn's gargantuan. I mean, that. My point is that wouldn't put me over that it was that
it was. I know
float.
It was a suggestion. It was a hint. It was like that. I figured somebody might say, would it still be the lightest planet if it had a large, solid, rocky core? It would have made you at least think about that. But anyway,
I'm sure it's still dense, Steve. Just because it's liquid doesn't mean there's not like liquid metallic hydrogen down there.
Well, yeah, it's metallic fluids.
Yeah, metallic hydrogen.
Yes,
I mean, it's some dense stuff.
Yeah, but they described it as fuzzy. The core is fuzzy.
Fuzzy.
It's a diffuse soup of ice, rock, and metallic fluids.
Yum.
But that was neat. I almost made that one the science about the rippling through the rings, but whatever, you know.
Yeah no, cool. That would have been cool too.
Yeah. All right. Well, good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Evan, give me a quote.
This week's quote was suggested by a listener, Vigo from Norway. Thank you so much for this. He said, I found this quote while reading Simon's book. He's saying Herbert A. Simon about his book, The Science of the Artificial. And he found it a quite beautiful quote. The goal of science is to make the wonderful and complex understandable and simple, but not less wonderful.
Yep.
Herbert A. Simon.
That is a poetic description of science communication.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Definitely. Yeah. Can't take the wonder out of it.
Yeah. Not simple, but not too simple. That's always the trick. Yeah, we were talking about that before the show, actually. It could be tricky to explain things where it's correct as far as it goes, but you're not writing a textbook with, you know, a technically dense treatise on the topic. Even though it really requires that to fully understand. Like we were talking about quantum computers. We're not going to give you an understanding of quantum computers on the show.
Mm-mm.
You know, even in the book, you know, in the book chapter about it, I'm trying to like, all right, you know, what level do we get to? Bob and I were talking about this the whole time. How deep do we go? Like how just enough so that you have an idea of what they can do and like kind of how they can work. But like a technical, I mean, of course, we can't do it. You know, obviously, there's many layers of complexity beyond our understanding. But even to the degree that we do understand it, it's like we can't cram that into a book chapter. You know, it's so
beyond
anyway,
the scope
always,
of our book,
it's just beyond the scope. So you're always making those choices with science communication. But you want to keep the wonder and the fascination. And make it understandable and at least not be wrong, at least at the level that you're describing.
Yeah, don't do science a disservice by your description.
Yeah.
Or foster some crazy beliefs. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. And
yeah, it is.
You know, a lot of our friends and colleagues are science communicators. We, you know, obviously read and interview and everything, a lot of science communicators. So we're kind of connoisseurs, if you will, of science communication. So we talk a lot about, you know, the nuances of who, the choices that different people make and how they work. Are they hyping that too much? Was that a good metaphor? Was that, you know what I mean? It's like, there's a lot of, you could just debate endlessly about how to do it. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And don't forget to drive safely this holiday weekend. It could happen very easily. You drink too much, you think you're okay to drive when you're actually not. Even if you live nearby, if you can get home okay, you might think that the odds of getting pulled over are not very high. But keep in mind, in addition to losing your license, losing your job, totaling your car, you could actually kill someone. So remember, it only takes one mistake to change your life or someone else's forever. Play it safe and plan ahead to get a ride. Drive sober or get pulled over.